Hey everybody, welcome to the Damage Report. I'm Brett Ehrlich, in for John Iadarola. Joining us in the Damage Report studio, Francesca Fiorentini.
What's going on?
You know, I want to thank you for joining us on literally the most difficult day of the year to do a morning show.
It truly is. California had getting rid of daylight savings time, or springing forward, or whatever fresh hell this is.
Yep.
And I'm for it. Like, when we break off and become our own country,
either through some kind of ballot initiative or giant earthquake.
Yeah, there'll be no more daylight savings time. Like, the San Andreas Fault can rip open and, you know, just swallow the Central Valley.
Yeah.
But at least we won't have to spring forward anymore.
It's worth it.
Yeah, no,
usually say not one person should be inconvenienced by my policies unless they can afford it. Even people. Take the poor, throw them into a giant crevasse so I can sleep an extra hour.
It's just the almond farmers. We got oat milk now.
That's so true. There's so many almond farmers. Anyways, now that we're here and ready to face, we have a lot going on in the show today. We have a block I like to refer to as sit down and shut up. There's a sit down debate and Bill Maher needs to shut up. Also, Ken Klippenstein on in the show. We're gonna talk about kleptocracy in America, from an expert who has studied it the world over to see how Trump's decisions have affected our nation and turned it more and more into a kleptocracy. We also are gonna go through the most amazing coronavirus bungles that the president's administration has carried out, as well as a White House shakeup. And if time, ladies and gentlemen, if time, who's sitting in for Jimmy Kimmel? In this week, it is a former candidate who will be sitting in for Jimmy Kimmel
to co-host the show. Elizabeth Warren, I swear to God.
She did SNL. Did you see any of that?
I did see the shimmy.
Yeah.
Not bad, pretty good.
Not bad, it was good.
Good moves, very cute. I wish it had a little bit more relevance to our current state of needing her endorsement for a progressive front. But hey, that's fine. Let her, you know, let her relax a little bit.
Everybody deserves it. You guys just relax. We're gonna get into the show right now. We're gonna talk about changes to the debate structure. So let's get right into it. After sitting down with the DNC, CNN has announced that they want to change the format of the upcoming debate away from what was originally planned, because this is going to be the first debate with just the two candidates going head to head, unless Tulsi Gabbard has anything to say about it. That's a real story. So here's what to look forward to. The format for the next debate in Arizona, as it is proposed, would have the candidates seated for the first time this election cycle and take multiple questions from the audience. In the prior 10 debates, the candidates stood at lecterns and nearly all questions were asked by the professional moderators. So why do you think that the DNC would like to have both candidates sit down?
I mean, it's the same reason that Biden will not do a long form interview with anyone, really. I know Rachel Maddow has been asking for like a week now to get an interview with the supposed front runner of the Democratic primary and hasn't gotten one yet. That's Maddow.
And has done an interview with Warren, who was out, but Bernie Sanders was like, yes, because he always does that. Jeff Weaver, who has been part of our debate coverage in the past, Bernie Sanders' senior advisor said, why does Joe Biden not want to stand toe-to-toe with Senator Sanders on the debate stage March 15th and have an opportunity to defend his record and articulate his vision for the future? And that's such a good attack, I think.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously we're saying that Joe Biden is clearly not good on his feet. For whatever reason, I think a lot of us are saying, except you won't really see it in mainstream news, that Biden clearly is demonstrating a lot of signs of dementia. He is rapidly declining. You see interviews from just like 3 years ago, 4 years ago. He sounds really cogent. If I may be so bold as to say, 4 years ago, he sounded like Trump senile, you know, not senile,
right,
but Trump level coherent.
Mm-hmm.
Because Trump understands the question and sort of has a beginning, middle, and end, even if it's the same word. And I think Biden doesn't have an end ever to his sentences.
Yeah.
He has a beginning and a middle, and then he sort of just peters out.
Right, and And Joe Biden, he has a stutter. It's well documented, his stutter, that he's tried to fight his entire life. And that's a difficult thing to overcome. I just don't see a correlation between the kind of meltdowns he's had during debates and the stutter that he seems to be trying to overcome. But then again, he did get off this amazing attack in a recent debate. Senator, I've served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy. Oh wait, no, that was Lloyd Benson in one of the best attacks in a debate of all time. Biden said, anyway, my time is up. I'm sorry, my bad. That's right, that's what he did.
I mean, this is clearly like, it's a cop out. And it's really sad because after having watched so many debates, right? Every single week, it seems like there's a new and another debate and there's 12 people on the stage. Oh, there's 8. Oh, cool. And Biden's sort of been able to skate through it all. And then finally, there's a chance to have a real substantive debate between two people, have them go toe to toe, answer, you know, what's your answer to that? What's your response to that? You know, just really get into it. Now they're going to triangulate with audience members, right? And that is so much more beneficial of a scenario to Biden. And it also is less confrontational. And I think we deserve to see something that is confrontational.
I would say if it's from the audience asking questions, that's not actually his strength either. Because every video that I've seen is of someone coming up to Biden and challenging him.
Right.
And being like, hey man, like recently we had someone from the military saying like, you're disqualified because your decisions leading up to the Iraq war have a legacy that still exists today and people are dead because of it, you're disqualified. And he freezes up. Other times he's like, vote for somebody else, vote for somebody else.
Right, or just listen, Jack. I mean, there'll be a lot of Jacks in that audience. I'm very excited.
The DNC is gonna pack the whole audience by just filling it with people named Jack. Jacqueline, Jacqueline. John? All right, that qualifies. Get in here, John. We're gonna call you Jack. Is that okay? Sit down.
James can be a Jack sometimes.
Yeah, James Jackie boy. It's so ridiculous. Do you want to hear one of the most amazing statements from the Biden campaign that I've ever seen?
Yes.
Kate Bedingfield, in her counter argument to Weaver, essentially said, it's odd to see a campaign, talking about the Sanders campaign, that says it is based on revolution, arguing for the status quo because, quote, this is how every other debate has gone. Why is Senator Sanders opposed to a little change?
Wow.
The spin trying to say that Sanders is opposed to change because he wants them to be standing the whole time. Someone who's been attacked because he had a heart attack and they're like, but even the guy who had a heart attack is like, no, I'm good standing.
Well, why is he so upset about his heart attack? I thought he wanted a change in the status quo. You know, like, a little bit of rain never hurt anyone.
Yeah.
Senator Sanders says he's got to cancel an event. I'm just making stuff up.
Right, it's like, oh, your heart was beating at a regular pace. Suddenly it starts beating faster and you have to go to the hospital. But this is so ridiculous to say that the person who's advocating for a massive change in pretty much everything across the board versus a dude whose pride and joy is that he's a moderate opposed to overhaul.
Yeah.
And then they're trying to say that because Sanders wants to stand up the whole time.
Right.
And Biden, who has just given us tons and tons and tons of gaffes, speaking at max 1/6 of the time.
Yeah.
Is now gonna speak half the time. That's what they're
opposed. Absolutely. And I think that it's not just gaffes, right? Gaffes, I think he's always done. And there is a line between gaffes and just not being able to coherently make a point. And I think Biden, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for someone who has struggled with a stutter, who publicly speaks all the time. And he's done an amazing job throughout his entire career. I don't see that Biden here. So let's just be fair to America in this instance and say that I'm not sure that he's up for this job. And I guess I just liken it to like, you know, you're sitting at Thanksgiving dinner, you know, and everyone's talking over grandpa. Mm-hmm. He can't really get a word in. And then everyone leaves and they're going to the kitchen and they go to the living room and they go to play video games. Grandpa's left. And you're like, man, finally hear grandpa, you know, over this din.
Uh-huh.
What do you gotta say? And he's like, listen, Jack, you're a lion-faced dog pony soldier and the moon landing. Well, I don't know, my time's up.
So ridiculous. Like, but and we'll see. We'll see what happens. Sitting down, they're going to give him the problem is they're going to give him every opportunity to have the advantage, and we'll see what he does with it. All right, we have to move on to the shut up portion of this, which is Bill Maher. So let's get into it. Bill Maher, I try to watch it every so often because I used to like Bill Maher. Bill Maher does jokes and I like jokes. But what he said about money in politics and Chris Matthews became a joke unto itself. First, after Chris Matthews was fired, here's what Maher had to say.
You know, MSNBC used to run this thing. This is who we are. Well, I didn't like who you were this week.
Right.
And I don't think a lot of people who work there like this either. And I think this cancel culture is a cancer on progressivism. Liberals always have to fight a two-front war. Republicans only have to fight the Democrats. Democrats have to fight the Republicans and each other.
Your own lunatics.
I just want to go through some of the horrible things that Chris Matthews did. First, he made an analogy. I'm going to read it fast because I don't even understand what the insult was. He was talking about Bernie Sanders' lead in Nevada. I was reading last night about the fall of France in the summer of 1940 and the General calls up Churchill and says, it's over. And Churchill says, how can it be? You've got the greatest army in Europe. How can it be over? Obviously, he's a Nazi. But he apologized for that. So I hope the victims got some closure.
This is Bill Maher pretending not to really understand the fact that Trump compared Bernie Sanders to Hitler. And that was not the only reason that Matthews was in trouble. There were other things that Matthews himself, or that Maher himself mentions, is Matthews said some things that are kind of creepy to women. This is Maher talking. Mm. You know, guys are married for a million years and they want to flirt for 2 seconds. He said to somebody, Laura Bassett, 4 years ago, she's in makeup, said, why haven't I fallen in love with you? Yes, it's creepy. She said, I was afraid to name him at the time out of fear of retaliation. I'm not afraid anymore. And then Bill Maher says, thank you, Rosa Parks. I mean, Jesus effing Christ, I guess my question is, do you wonder how Democrats lose? And it's like, this is the thing. Like, yeah, what do you think?
What's the thing? I mean, there's so much to unpack. Obviously, Bill Maher needs to retire. I don't believe in cancel culture, except for in his instance. I mean, the reason he's saying this is because he's obviously said the exact same thing to women for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And we know Bill Maher used to be relevant in the 90s. You know, you're making like BJ jokes with Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton. That's great, man. But the sun is setting on his political relevance. It has been for a long time. And look, as a comic, I get it. You have to find a unique take, a unique angle. You have to like ruffle feathers and all of this. This is not unique. Like being retrograde and defending basically sexual misconduct and calling a woman Rosa Parks, ironically, like that's just what the right does.
Yeah. He's belittling this experience, which is quite obviously like a giant issue in Hollywood. Like I worked at a talent agency in like 2004 and that was right in the thick. Like we had to go to a set like karaoke bars as like a trip. And it was the most fratty experience ever as like we were belittled by having money thrown at us. And I was a dude. Like I was a frat dude.
What kind of karaoke bar were you going to?
It was like a private room. So when I think back on it, it felt like we were at a strip club essentially and they were throwing money at us to perform for them. And I'm a frat boy. I'm literally a frat boy. And I'm like, this is weird, but I'm not gonna say anything because I'm terrified that they're gonna be mad at me. Like the things I overheard are bad. And the things have changed according to everybody, but it's just so bad. And there's so many things. Yes, he will stay. I think he still is relevant because much like The View, he's indicative of where certain people's heads are at. And when you see, and I need that. Otherwise, I have no idea what's going on. When I see Bill Maher, I see all the comments of people kind of backing him up, being like, finally someone said it.
No, I think if anyone's backing him up, it's definitely more right wingers than it is anybody else. I think he's just trying to say something different. He's trying to go against what everyone else says. Mm-hmm. Like I'm saying, he's trying to find a unique angle and his angles and his takes are bad.
Yeah.
They're just bad. And it's too bad that like one of the best like channels, HBO, has I think someone who's pushing the edge on comedy, which is John Oliver, mm-hmm. and someone who really, you know, he is the Chris Matthews of comedy.
Yeah. We'll see. But still, I would love to see someone from TYT on that show, just to get the other side of the argument back at them, because they're making a lot of assumptions.
He would just talk over you.
Yeah. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about kleptocracy and how it has made its way into the Trump administration. Don't go away. We'll be back. We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time. Coronavirus, COVID-19 continues to spread all around the country and the world. And the president thinks that everything is going just fine, but I've put together some of my favorite amazing bungles so far. And I just wanna go through, just so everyone gets a feel for what I've been feeling going through the news about this. So first we're gonna go with our dear friend Ben Carson, who was on one of the Sunday shows with George Stephanopoulos, who asked, in the wake, there's this cruise ship that's been off the coast of California, and it's supposed to come into shore now about 50 hours before it's supposed to dock. The president had a meeting with those people to come up with a plan through Mike Pence. And Carson was asked about it. Here's his response.
They are coming up with a plan within 72 hours of that meeting.
The ship's docking tomorrow.
The plan will be in place by that time. But I don't want to preview the plan right now.
Shouldn't you be able to do that?
I think it needs to all come from a solitary source. We shouldn't have 16 people saying what the plan is.
Okay,
particularly when it hasn't been fully formulated.
So Ben Carson, he doesn't want to talk about the plan, which doesn't exist, but will, even though by the timeline that he set out, it won't exist. Ben Carson is a doctor.
Ben Carson is like, you know, you're in a restaurant and someone is choking and it's like, does anyone know the Heimlich? And someone's like, I don't know, but I know how to do this with my tongue.
And also, like, Ben Carson's like, someone's choking over here. Is anyone a doctor? And Ben Carson's like, I am. It's like, okay, come over here and save their life. They've got seconds. And he's just like, okay. And then he just goes.
Here I go. Yeah, no, it's like, it is so offensive to Ben Carson and to all doctors that is literally what's happening in the White House is let's just wheel out a doctor. And to be honest with you, I saw this whole interview and I feel like he's doing a better job at preventing himself from saying something he will later regret,
right,
or giving out misinformation, because the truth of the matter is they don't have their messaging straight. And so at least he's like erring on the side of caution.
Mm-hmm. But at least like, you need to communicate to us that you do have a plan for everything. I mean,
sure.
I know he doesn't have a plan for housing and urban development, which is his actual job. And similar to how they just brought out a doctor for this, they just brought out a black person to be in charge of HUD, let's be honest. Okay, the next thing was this image of Matt Gaetz who in the wake of, or during, amid the flood of coronavirus reports, said reviewing the coronavirus supplemental appropriation and preparing to go vote. This is when they were voting on the amount of stuff they needed to appropriate to deal with the virus, the $8 billion, I think it was. But like, this looks like an image from a sexual harassment training video. This is bullying. This is what you learn about. This is bullying. Like, I feel so bad for the person who has to stand there next to him as he's wearing a gas mask.
Yeah, but it's like a sexual harassment training video once, like according to men's rights activism. You know, it's like the female will try to bring you into her orbit and trick you into harassing her. Therefore, you must wear a mask. Like, also, he had to approve that photo going out, and he looks absolutely ridiculous.
It's, I mean, someone tweeted like, men are not funny. I think it was Aaron Ryan, like, men are not funny. Because this is like, he thinks he's being absolutely hilarious. He's trying to.
Is that what that is?
I think so. He's trying to downplay the crisis.
Yes.
Somehow.
I get it. Oh, right, they take nothing seriously.
Everybody's overreacting to this thing that has literally killed people. And I didn't even pull that video where there was some financial advisor who was like, I think you reported on this as well on Friday's show, that was like, hey, maybe we should just give it to everybody.
Yeah.
But like, that's the thing. And for him to say that he wasn't, this is all overblown and no one's been exposed to this crisis. Here's a little bit. At the conservative CPAC conference, an attendee of a conservative conference where the president and Vice President Mike Pence spoke last week, an attendee has tested positive for the coronavirus, according to the event's organizer. So CPAC, not to mention APAC was contaminated. Mm-hmm. Matt Gaetz is trying to play this down while half of Congress, the conservatives, are being exposed to this at CPAC.
Yeah, conservatives. That's interesting how it's hitting them harder. And I'll just say, life finds a way.
Divine intervention, like the chosen people.
Yeah, coronavirus is like, Mother Nature is very much like, oh, y'all are gonna elect Biden, nominate him as to go against Trump. Okay, we're gonna do this my way.
It's amazing. And like,
coronavirus is making Democrats look weak, is what I'm trying to say.
It is trying to make Senator Ted Cruz and Paul Gosar said they aren't experiencing symptoms. They were at CPAC, but will self-quarantine until 14 days have passed since the interaction at the conference.
His family's like, oh no, daddy has to go into quarantine. We can't give him a hug or kiss.
Right.
Oh no.
Paul Gosar is the representative whose family made an ad saying like, we're for the other guy. That was the one that had like five brothers and sisters be like, I'm Tammy Gosar, Billy Gosar, Tommy Gosar. We all endorse our brother's opponent. So apparently the family's been self-quarantining for quite some time now. Not to mention Mike Pence. They'd said that Mike Pence and Donald Trump were not exposed to the virus at CPAC. They stayed away from him. But still, this headline from a week ago says, Mike Pence shook hands with classmates of a Florida schoolboy who's now in quarantine with mother after she, quote, came in contact with a coronavirus patient. So Mike Pence, the guy in charge of all this, the virus czar, may have exposed himself to some children. And I know that sounds weird, but I'm talking about a virus.
You have to find some joy in all of this fear. And I think we found it. Obviously, we don't wish ill on anyone. But I do think it's ironic that the guy who actually believes in Old Testament plagues is in charge of preventing an Old Testament plague from taking over the country.
We have a plan for if there's frogs and boils. Yeah. If there was a coronavirus, if like the 10th plague wasn't the angel of death, but rather COVID-19.
Like, he might come out and be like, well, that maybe that little boy was living in sin and he was looking at the other little boys and COVID-19 is God's will. Like, that's not beyond the pale at this point.
Another thing that happened, the Dow drops sharply after markets reopened following a 15-minute trading pause in the wake of oil prices going way, way, way down because no one's using shipping as much as they used to. People aren't traveling as much as they used to. So the demand for crude oil is going down. And there was a couple things about this headline, about what's happening here, is they went so crazy on the floor of every stock market in the world. They have a rule where they have to take a 15-minute timeout.
Yeah, is that a moment of silence?
It's just like a wait till the cocaine wears off. Just take a second, just drink some half and half and get it. You know, get the cream to just like coat everything.
Out of those little containers. Just pound some half and half.
That's like that's a Brooklyn Nine-Nine joke.
Okay. I was like, all right.
But like,
go with it.
So we have that. And then Trump's response to that was Saudi Arabia and Russia are just arguing over the price and flow of oil. And the fake news is the reason for the market drop. No, it's not, dude. The reason for the market drop is because this is like phase two. Yeah. There was a lot of people being like, I'm gonna sell off. This seems like an international crisis, may affect the global supply chain. Things like the oil, OPEC trying to get everyone to lower the price. And then Russia saying, no, bro, I'm not gonna do that. And then Saudi Arabia being like, well, then I guess I have to mob style, like bleed you dry. That's happening because of coronavirus. It's not just them arguing over the price of oil. That's why this is step two of many steps, bud.
Yeah, Corona is, again, I will say it again, it's big, big old socialist. Just like, you know, crashing markets, you know, filleting capitalists left and right. This is it. I mean, but to be totally serious with you, like, it is scary. Obviously, there are people whose lives are invested in the stock market for right or wrong, retirement funds that shouldn't be but are. But it is a little bit of a glimpse into, I think, what a lot of specifically climate activists have talked about when it comes to what would like a post-fossil fuel future look like. Mm-hmm. And what would it look like if we bought locally and we didn't fly goods around the world at the expense of the world, right? And it would mean there would be less growth for the 1% and for a particular class and elite of people. Yeah. That doesn't mean, though, that we're all going to perish. And I don't know about you. I mean, unless there are like millionaires and people with a lot of stock out there, like that's great, good for you. But like most folks don't live that life.
Yeah.
So I think it is this bizarre moment of, yeah, if there are major stocks markets crashing, how do we have to turn and rely on ourselves and local economies and local communities? Mm-hmm. If I may be so revolutionary.
Yeah. If we are dependent on the sun and oil futures plummet, then this statement is like, oh, God, sorry, bummer.
Thank you, Brett.
The last thing that I want to show you is Trump when he's asked about what's going on here and the severity of the crisis. He cannot resist the opportunity to talk about the town hall he had on Fox. Mm. Take a look.
As of the time I left the plane with you, we had 240 cases, and that's at least what was on a very fine network known as Fox News. I know you love it, but that's what I happen to be watching. And how was the show last night? Did it get good ratings, by the way?
I don't know.
Oh, really? I heard it broke this, but maybe that's wrong. That's what they told me. I mean, I can't imagine that.
Asked about the severity of the crisis, he's like, do people watch? Did people watch?
Ew.
And I gotta believe that like the sound in the background, they're on one of those like Avengers style helipads. It's just like somewhere, like what are we doing? Where are we? He's at the CDC for that. But
no, and he looks like even more disgusting than usual if you get a chance to watch this, just in a zip up jacket and a horrible red hat.
His font size has increased.
The font size is bigger. It actually looks like it's been photoshopped onto his hat in post. And clearly making everything about himself.
Yeah.
And I think that's what even people who somehow still support this president have to remind themselves of, that this guy will throw everyone in the entire country under the bus. You can all get sick if he did well on Fox News and he's got good ratings.
So bad. All right, we gotta take a break. Speaking about shows with amazing ratings, this one, we'll be back after this. The president has been on a pardoning spree, and there seems to be some patterns behind those pardons and who he chooses to, whose sentences he's going to commute. And our guest, Sarah Shazy, wrote a piece in The Atlantic called "This Is How Kleptocracies Work," because that pattern seems to remind her of various kleptocracies the world over, which she has studied in depth, and she joins us now. What is a kleptocracy for our viewers? Let's start there.
Corruption exists in every society, obviously. The difference is when it becomes not a sort of aberration that individual venal officials indulge in and often get caught and punished, but rather when it becomes what you could think of as the operating system for not just a government, but I would say networks that weave government officials together with business executives and very often out and out criminals. And these networks are out for basically their own enrichment. And they bend the instruments of state, right? The agencies and institutions that have the power of government, they bend those to serve not the people, but the network. That's a kleptocracy.
I know. This morning as I was preparing, I was trying to say kleptocracy. And democracy is ruining one's ability to pronounce kleptocracy because that T gets right in there, stealing the focus like people do in a kleptocracy. So what are some of the patterns within Trump's pardoning process that have you a little on guard, I guess, about whether we are headed toward the kinds of kleptocracies that you've studied in other parts of the world?
The instrument of state or the agency that every single kleptocracy I have looked at or lived in has to capture is the justice function. And the reason for that is these networks are held together by a bargain. Money gets distributed within the network. And interestingly, it often flows upwards from subordinates up through the ranks to superiors. So what do the subordinates get in return for their loyalty and often a cut of the take that they're pocketing? What they get is impunity. They get, no legal repercussions. And that is the most important thing that the top of the network has to deliver to those underneath. Therefore, the top of the network has to control the justice function. So that's when I started seeing these pardons, and not just the pardons, but the direct interference by President Trump in, sentencing recommendations and things like that. It just looked, I've lived through this in other countries. I actually lived in Afghanistan for a decade and worked on anti-corruption efforts there. And I watched an incredibly difficult case get ended by a telephone call by President Karzai, who ordered the suspect released, and eventually the charges were dropped against him. This was an open and shut case. There was beautiful evidence. Afghan police had developed the case. They were all scattered and sent to the boonies, basically. And what was really interesting about it, it's kind of similar to Trump's tweets. President Karzai did not hide the fact that he had directly interfered with a perfectly legal judicial proceeding. Rather, he kind of trumpeted it. And that is the event that caused me to understand that this was a system, because it was completely illogical that in the circumstances, President Karzai should want everybody to know that he had, just muscled his way into this process. And that's when I realized, wow, he was sending a message to the other members of the network to say, don't worry, I got your back. The deal is safe with me. And I find that President Trump's actions in the pardons that he has granted, and in the very public way, the tweeting even after his Attorney General William Barr basically told him, would you knock it off? It's making it harder for me to do what you want me to do. President Trump is very interested in broadcasting to the people whose loyalty he wants to secure or cement that he will do, he will basically bend the course of justice of the United States judicial function in their favor.
So we don't have a lot of time. My last question for you is, so how do you stop it? You've been in many countries where this kind of thing has happened. Have you been in any that have successfully thwarted this kind of kleptocracy growth? And if so, or if not, where did they fail? What can we do to fix it?
So what is, it's really difficult once they have established themselves, but what is clear is several different things are needed. A vast public mobilization against corruption in government across the board. It can't be factionalized. It can't be, oh, I'll turn a blind eye on my party or my sect or whatever. There needs to be judicial sanction and there needs to be reform, meaning some people need to go to jail. And there needs to be reform legislation to turn what may have been norms in the past into hard-edged law. And I would say what kleptocratic networks use most effectively to dismantle or disable a broad-based opposition is identity divides. And I've seen it in Lebanon, I've seen it in Romania, I've seen it in Afghanistan, I've seen it in all of these countries where the elites in Nigeria, the elites are working together in these integrated networks. They're sometimes, you know, beset by rivalries or whatever, but they very effectively divide up the opposition along deep-seated identity divides. So, you know, if we American citizens wish to get the better of this, we're going to have to overcome all of the cleavages of party, of race, of gender, and even to some extent of our attitudes toward people on the other side of those divides.
Sarah Shays, thank you so much for joining us from so far away. Everyone should check out your article, This Is How Kleptocracies Work. Also your book, Thieves of State. And I know you have an upcoming book called On Corruption in America about more or less this very thing coming out in August. So thank you for joining us on The Damage Report.
An honor. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, everybody, we got to take a break. We'll be back with Ken Klippenstein after this. Bloomberg fell down and went Boomberg, and Kenny Klippenstein sorted through the ashes of people who used to work for him and asked them a few questions, and some of them approached him. Ken Klippenstein joins us now on The Damage Report. How do you do, sir?
Hey, Brett, great to be on.
Fantastic to have you. Your article in The Nation is called This Was a Grift, Bloomberg Staffers Explain Campaign's Demise. So what was the demise? What was it like talking to these people and what did you find?
Well, it's pretty astonishing because usually when a campaign ends, people are disappointed. It's perhaps not shocked. They may have seen the writing on the wall, but there's a sense of, feeling like you invested a bunch of time and energy into something that ultimately didn't end up working. So even if it didn't come as a surprise, there's this kind of sadness that settles on these campaigns. That was not the case with the Bloomberg campaign. If anything, it was sort of giddiness to see this person whom, you know, many described themselves as grifting to work for, crash and burn after having spent, $700 million on this campaign. And that was a very unusual response, at least as far as campaigns that I've seen in the past.
So, right, because I saw in the wake of Warren being out of the election, folks being like, I literally just need some time before I move on. So why are Bloomberg staffers specifically the ones who are so giddy and refer to it as a grift? Is it because of those stories I've heard where he spent a bunch of money on staffers?
Yeah, well, staffers tend to be younger folks, either just out of college or, you know, around that age, don't have a lot of money. The way things are now, not a whole lot of options. So I think it was essentially a mercenary campaign. And many will tell you that, straight up, that they joined because he offered a, you know, really ostentatious set of perks, including, I just learned today, many of them will be able to keep their high-end MacBooks and iPhones in addition to getting paid far and away the highest, way above what staffers for other candidates, Biden or Sanders, for instance, would get paid. And then also it was less competitive to sort of get in it. So I think those create the ingredients for a sort of mercenary force that is going to want to, you know, take everything that's not nailed down, but at the same time, perhaps not, or at least according to the folks I talked to, certainly not believe in the message of the Bloomberg campaign.
So that's it. Like, I've seen that in so many movies and TV shows where, like, the mercenaries don't defend their homeland like the countrymen themselves. Did you talk to anyone who's moving on to other campaigns? Or were these people who just kind of stepped forward because they're like, I know a lot of people that work for the census because they're just like, the census pays well, man, and it's easy.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's going to be a bit of a, you know, selection bias here, and that the folks that reach out to me, I would assume, are going to, you know, be unhappy with the campaign. But I want to stress, this is not based on, you know, two or three people. You know, I talked to about a dozen people specifically for the story, and more than that in general. And I was just blown away. And I'll tell you, other reporters were blown away by the sort of chattiness on the part of the campaign. I think there was a sense of responsibility to, since they're pushing this campaign that they don't believe in, try to, you know, offset some of that. And I get into it in the story where I describe someone saying, you know, I feel guilty that I sold my soul for this for a buck. And in terms of working for this campaign, I tend to have a bit of sympathy for a lot of these folks, since, you know, without getting into specifics, I don't want to get anyone in trouble. You know, many of them are not, you know, folks with a whole lot of options at this point in time. So I think they tried to offset what they perceived as doing something they didn't believe in by helping to inform the public in many regards, while perhaps making a bit of money themselves.
Yeah.
So yeah, it certainly, there was a sell-sword aspect to all of it.
That's amazing. Your article is such an amazing read. I wish we had more time, but we've run out of time. Ken Klippenstein, what are you working on right now?
Coronavirus. Plenty of good news on that front. So keep your eyes peeled.
All right, we will. And everyone follow Ken Klippenstein, because you on Twitter are amazing, sir.
I appreciate it.
All right, thank you guys so much. Thank you for joining us. We gotta take a break. When we come back, just an amazing moment on the Today Show this morning. Don't go away.
This, because a little birdie told me you might be hosting a late night show.
Yeah, on Thursday I'm going to be guest hosting Jimmy Kimmel Live, so we're really excited for that. Lining up a great slate of guests. Sir Patrick Stewart's coming on. We're very excited about that.
Amy Klobuchar, she going to be a guest, perhaps?
You know, I'm hoping to catch up with her soon. But
you're going to do monologue and everything.
Yeah. Well, hopefully some funnier minds than mine will be doing some writing for that. But
someone's still got to say it.
He'll take a break from all that crying and host Kimmel. I mean, I've never seen him look sadder.
Like then?
Like usually there's sadness behind that smile. There always is. But this time there really just lots of sadness. Also, whatever. Let him do it. Let him. Listen, Kimmel is like if Buttigieg had a personality. You know, like it's like his alter ego of like, man, if I just hadn't have stayed late and studied and, you know, and after school, I just went out and played whatever sports.
It's just like, Kimmel, I don't know. I wouldn't have expected this to happen. I think everyone wanted Buttigieg to be Obama. So, like a lot of people anyways, wanted Buttigieg to be Obama. He clearly is one of them doing his Obama impression. But there seems, when I watched a lot of his town halls and debates, there's a difference between Obama and Buttigieg. It's that in watching them both, Obama could deliver a joke.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And I can't imagine, like, if Buttigieg is gonna be able to pull this off, and like, what are they gonna do? They're gonna do what you see happens a lot. They're gonna try to write jokes that make it so that he doesn't have to do a lot of heavy lifting. He's gonna do some interviewing. But this does seem like a reaching out and being like, Pete Buttigieg, we don't want you to go away.
Maybe.
I think so. I mean, it's like
you're still
him?
A celeb in our eyes. I don't know. I mean, I'm actually genuinely curious about Buttigieg now. I'd love to hear, and I haven't actually heard a good interview with him. Because I feel like if there's one moment for him to be a little bit honest, it would be now. Of like, did you get a call from former President Barack Obama to drop out and endorse Biden? What was that like? How was it like?
I don't know if he would go so far as to divulge a private conversation with the president of the United States, former president of the United States. But I don't know, with Buttigieg, America, as much as a lot of people rejected him, America loves a comeback story. So we'll see. That's all the time we have. Won't you come back next time? Thank you, Francesca.
Thank you, Brett.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.